approach. "Thanks, guys." David was almost crying. "Thanks a fucking pantload." He stalked out with his head down and his folder clutched in one hand. The following semester, he left Chamberlain and joined a frat. All things considered, that was probably for the best. As Stoke might have said, Deary had lost his credibility. "So you stole that, too," Stoke Jones said from his bed in the infirmary when he could finally talk. I had just told him that almost everyone in Chamberlain Hall was now wearing the Sparrow Track on at least one article of clothing, thinking this news would cheer him up. I had been wrong. "Settle down, man," Skip said, patting his shoulder. "Don't have a hemorrhage." Stoke never so much as glanced at him. His black, accusing eyes remained on me. "You took the credit, then you took the peace sign. Did any of you check my wallet? I think there were $9 or $10 in there. You could have had that, too, made it a clean sweep." He turned his head aside and began to cough weakly. On that cold day in early December of 66, he looked one fuck of a lot older than 18. This was 4 days after Stoke went swimming in Bennett's Run. The doctor, Carberry his name was, seemed by the second of those days to accept that most of us were Stoke's friends no matter how oddly we'd acted when we brought him in, because we kept stopping by to ask after him. Carberry had been at the college infirmary, prescribing for strep throats and splitting wrists dislocated in softball games, for donkey's years, and probably knew there was no accounting for the behavior of young men and women homing in on their majority. They might look like adults, but most retained plenty of their childhood weirdnesses as well. Nick Prouty auditioning Foghorn Leghorn for the Dean of Men, for instance. I rest my case. Carberry never told us how bad things had been with Stoke. One of the candy stripers, half in love with Skip by the second time she saw him, I believe, gave us a clearer picture, not that we really needed one. The fact that Carberry stuck him in a private room instead of on men's side told us something. The fact that we weren't allowed to so much as peek in on him for the first 48 hours of his stay told us more. The fact that he hadn't been moved to Eastern Maine, which was only 10 miles up the road, told us most of all. Carberry hadn't dared move him, not even in the university ambulance. Stoke Jones had been in bad straits indeed. According to the candy striper, he had pneumonia, incipient hypothermia from his dunk, and a temperature which crested at 105 degrees. She'd overheard Carberry talking with someone on the phone and saying that if Jones's lung capacity had been any further reduced by his disability, or if he'd been in his 30s or 40s instead of his late teens, he almost certainly would have died. Skip and I were the first visitors he was allowed. Any other kid in the dorm probably would have been visited by at least one parent, but that wasn't going to happen in Stokes' case. We knew that now. And if there were other relatives, they hadn't bothered to put in an appearance. We told him everything that had happened that night, with one exception, the laugh-in, which had begun in the lounge when we saw him spraying his way through Bennett's Run, and continued until we delivered him, semi-conscious, to the infirmary. He listened silently as I told him about Skip's idea to put peace signs on our books and clothes so Stoke couldn't be hung out all by himself. Even Ronnie Malenfant had gone along, I said, and without a single quibble. We told him so he could jibe his story with ours. We also told him so he'd understand that by trying to take the blame or credit for the graffiti now, he'd get us in trouble as well as himself. And we told him without ever coming right out and telling him. We didn't need to. His legs didn't work, but the stuff between his ears was just fine. "Get your hand off me, Kirk." Stoke hunched as far away from us as his narrow bed would allow, then began to cough again. I remember thinking he looked like he had about 4 months to live, but I was wrong about that. Atlantis sank, but Stoke Jones is still in the swim, practicing law in San Francisco. His black hair has gone silver and is prettier than ever. He's got a red wheelchair and looks great on CNN. Skip sat back and folded his arms. "I didn't expect wild gratitude, but this is too much," he said. "You've outdone yourself this time, Rip-Rip." His eyes flashed. "Don't call me that." Then don't call us thieves just because we tried to save your scrawny ass. Hell, we did save your scrawny ass. No one asked you to. No, I said. You don't ask anyone for anything, do you? I think you're going to need bigger crutches to haul around the chip on your shoulder before long. That chip's what I've got, shithead. What have you got? A lot of catching up to do. That's what I had. But I didn't tell Stoke that. Somehow, I didn't think he'd exactly melt with sympathy. How much of that day do you remember? I asked him. I remember putting the fuck Johnson thing on the dorm. I'd been planning that for a couple of weeks, and I remember going to my 1 o'clock class. I spent most of it thinking about what I was going to say in the dean's office when he called me in. What kind of a statement I was going to make. After that, everything fades into little fragments. He uttered a sardonic laugh and rolled his eyes in their bruised-looking sockets. He'd been in bed for the best part of a week and still looked unutterably tired. I think I remember telling you guys I wanted to die. Did I say that? I didn't answer. He gave me all the time in the world, but I stood on my right to remain silent. At last, Stoke shrugged, the kind of shrug that says, "Okay, let's drop it." It pulled the Johnny he was wearing off one bony shoulder. He tugged it back into place, using his hand carefully. There was an IV drip in it. "So you guys discovered the peace sign, huh? Great. You can wear it when you go to see Neil Diamond or fucking Petula Clark at Winter Carnival. Me? I'm out of here. This is over for me. If you go to school on the other side of the country, do you think you'll be able to throw the crutches away?" Skip asked. "Maybe run track?" I was a little shocked, but Stoke smiled. It was a real smile, too, sunny and unaffected. "The crutches aren't relevant," he said. "Time's too short to waste. That's relevant. People around here don't know what's happening, and they don't care. They're gray people, just getting by people. In Orono, Maine, buying a Rolling Stones record passes for a revolutionary act." "Some people know more than they did," I said. But I was troubled by thoughts of Nate, who had been worried his mother might see a picture of him getting arrested and had stayed on the curb in consequence. A face in the background, the face of a gray boy on the road to dentistry in the 20th century. Dr. Carberry stuck his head in the door. "Time you were on your way, men. Mr. Jones has a lot of rest to catch up on." We stood. "When Dean Gerritsen comes to talk to you," I said, "or that guy Eversole, as far as they'll ever know, that whole day is a blank," Stoke said. "Carberry can tell them I had bronchitis since October and pneumonia since Thanksgiving, so they'll have to accept it. I'll say I could have done anything that day, except, you know, drop the old crutches and run the 440. "We really didn't steal your sign, you know," Skip said. "We just borrowed it." Stoke appeared to think this over, then sighed. "It's not my sign," he said. "No," I agreed. "Not anymore. So long, Stoke. We'll come back and see you." "Don't make it a priority," he said, and I guess we took him at his word because we never did. I saw him back at the dorm a few times, but only a few, and I was in class when he moved out without bothering to finish the semester. The next time I saw him was on the TV news almost 20 years later, speaking at a Greenpeace rally just after the French blew up the Rainbow Warrior. 1984 or 85, that would have been. Since then, I've seen him on the tube quite a lot. He raises money for environmental causes, speaks on college campuses from that snazzy red wheelchair, defends the eco-activists in court when they need defending. I've heard him called a tree hugger, and I bet he sort of enjoys that. He's still carrying that chip. I'm glad. Like he said, it's what he's got. As we reached the door, he called, "Hey?" We looked back at a narrow white face on a white pillow above a white sheet, the only real color about him those masses of black hair. The shapes of his legs under the sheet again made me think of Uncle Sam in the 4th of July parade back home. And again I thought that he looked like a kid with about 4 months to live, but add some white teeth to the picture as well, because Stoke was smiling. "Hey, what?" Skip said. "You two were so concerned with what I was going to say to Gerritsen and Eversole. Maybe I've got an inferiority complex or something, but I have trouble believing all that concern is for me. Have you two decided to actually try going to school for a change? If we did, do you think we'd make it? Skip asked. You might, Stokes said. There is one thing I remember about that night, pretty clearly, too. I thought he'd say he remembered us laughing at him. Skip thought so, too, he told me later, but that wasn't it. You carried me through the doorway of the exam room by yourself, he said to Skip. Didn't drop me, either. No chance of that. You don't weigh much. Still, dying's one thing, but no one likes the idea of being dropped on the floor. It's undignified. Because you didn't, I'll give you some good advice. Get out of the sports programs, Kirk. Unless, that is, you've got some kind of athletic scholarship you can't do without. Why? Because they'll turn you into someone else. It may take a little longer than it took Rotzi to turn David Dearborn into Deary, but they'll get there in the end. What do you know about sports? Skip asked gently. What do you know about being on a team? I know it's a bad time for boys in uniforms, Stokes said, then lay back on his pillow and closed his eyes. But a good time to be a girl, Carol had said. 1966 was a good time to be a girl. We returned to the dorm and went to my room to study. Down the hall, Ronnie and Nick and Lenny and most of the others were chasing the bitch. After a while, Skip shut the door to block the sound of them out. And when that didn't entirely work, I turned on Nate's little RCA swing line and we listened to Phil Oakes. Oakes is dead now, as dead as my mother and Michael Landon. He hanged himself with his belt right around the time Stoke Jones was going high profile with Greenpeace. The suicide rate among surviving Atlanteans has been pretty high. No surprise there, I guess. When your continent sinks right out from under your feet, it does a number on your head. A day or two after that visit to Stoke in the infirmary, I called my mother and said that if she could really afford to send a little extra cash my way, I'd like to take her up on her idea about getting a tutor. She didn't ask many questions and didn't scold. You knew you were in serious trouble with my mom when she didn't scold. But 3 days later, I had a money order for $300. To this, I added my heart's winnings. I was astonished to find they came to almost $80. That's a lot of nickels. I never told my mom, but I actually hired two tutors with her $300. One a grad student who helped me with the mysteries of tectonic plates and continental drift. The other a pot-smoking senior from King Hall who helped Skip with his anthropology and might have written a paper or two for him, although I don't know that for sure. This second fellow's name was Harvey Brundage, and he was the first person to ever say, "Wow, man, bummer," in my presence. Together, Skip and I went to the Dean of Arts and Sciences. There was no way we were going to go to Gerritsen, not after that November meeting in the Chamberlain Rec, and laid out the problems we were facing. Technically, neither of us belonged to ANS. As freshmen, we weren't yet eligible to declare majors, but Dean Randall listened to us. He recommended that we go around to each of our instructors and explain the problem. More or less throw ourselves on their mercy. We did it, loathing every minute of the process. One of the factors that made us powerful friends in those years was being raised with the same Yankee ideas, one of which was that you didn't ask for help unless you absolutely had to, and maybe not even then. The only thing that got us through that embarrassing round of calls was the buddy system. When Skip was in with his teachers, I waited for him out in the hall, smoking one cigarette after another. When it was my turn, he waited for me. As a group, the instructors were a lot more sympathetic than I ever would have guessed. Most bent over backwards to help us not only pass, but pass high enough to hold on to our scholarships. Only Skip's calculus teacher was completely unreceptive, and Skip was doing well enough there to skate by without any special help. Years later, I realized that for many of the instructors, it was a moral issue rather than an academic one. They didn't want to read their ex-students' names in a casualty list, and have to wonder if they had been partially responsible, that the difference between a D and a C minus had also been the difference between a kid who could see and hear and one sitting senseless in a VA hospital somewhere. After one of these meetings, and with the end of semester exams looming, Skip went to the Bear's Den to meet his anthro tutor for a coffee-fueled cram session. I had dish line at Holyoke. When the conveyor finally shut down for the afternoon, I went back to the dorm to resume my own studies. I stopped in the lobby to check my mailbox, and there was a pink package slip in it. The package was brown paper and string, but livened up with some stick-on Christmas bells and holly. The return address hit me in the stomach like an unexpected sucker punch. Carol Gerber, 172 Broad Street, Harwich, Connecticut. I hadn't tried to call her, and not just because I was busy trying to save my ass. I don't think I realized the real reason until I saw her name on that package. I'd been convinced she'd gone back to Sully John, that the night we'd made love in my car while the oldies played was ancient history to her now, that I was ancient history. Phil Oakes was playing on Nate's record player, but Nate himself was snoozing on his bed with a copy of Newsweek lying open on his face. General William Westmoreland was on the cover. I sat down at my desk, put the package in front of me, reached for the string, then paused. My fingers were trembling. "Hearts are tough," she had said. "Most times they don't break, most times they only bend." She was right, of course, but mine hurt as I sat there looking at the Christmas package she had sent me. It hurt plenty. Phil Oakes was on the record player, but in my mind I was hearing older, sweeter music. In my mind, I was hearing the Platters. I snapped the string, tore the tape, removed the brown paper, and eventually liberated a small white department store box. Inside was a gift wrapped in shiny red paper and white satin ribbon. There was also a square envelope with my name written on it, in her familiar hand. I opened the envelope and pulled out a Hallmark card, "When you care enough to send the very best," and all that. There were foil snowflakes and foil angels blowing foil trumpets. When I opened the card, a newspaper clipping fell out onto the present she'd sent me. It was from a newspaper called the Harwich Journal. In the top margin, above the headline, Carol had written, "This time I made it, Purple Heart. Don't worry, 5 stitches at the emerge room and I was home for supper." The story's headline read, 6 injured, 14 arrested as draft office protest turns into melee. The photo was in stark contrast to the one in the Derry News, where everyone, even the cops and the construction workers who had started their own impromptu counter-protest, looked sort of relaxed. In the Harwich Journal photo, folks looked raw-nerved, confused, and about 2,000 light-years from relaxed. There were hard-hat types with tattoos on their bulging arms and hateful grimaces on their faces. There were long-haired kids staring back at them with angry defiance. One of the latter was holding his arms out to a jeering trio of men as if to say, "Come on, you want a piece of me?" There were cops between the two groups, looking strained and tense. To the left, Carol had drawn an arrow to this part of the photo, as if I might have missed it otherwise, was a familiar jacket with Harwich High School printed on the back. Once more her head was turned, but this time toward the camera instead of away from it. I could see the blood running down her cheek much more clearly than I wanted to. She could draw joke arrows and write all the breezy comments she wanted to in the margin. I was not amused. That was not chocolate syrup on her face. A cop had her by one arm. The girl in the news photo didn't seem to mind either that or the fact that her head was bleeding, if she even knew her head was bleeding at that point. The girl in the news photo was smiling. In one of her hands was a sign reading, "Stop the murder." The other was held out toward the camera, the first 2 fingers making a V. V for victory, I thought then, but of course it wasn't. By 1969, that V went with the sparrow track the way ham went with eggs. I scanned the text of the clipping, but there was nothing there of any particular interest. Protest, counter-protest, epithets, thrown rocks, a few fistfights, police arrive on the scene. The story's tone was lofty and disgusted and patronizing all at the same time. It reminded me of how Ebersole and Gerritsen had looked that night in the wreck. You fellows have disappointed me. All but three of the protesters who had been arrested were released later that day, and none were named, so presumably they were all under 21. Blood on her face, and yet she was smiling, triumphant in fact. I became aware Phil Oakes was still singing, "I must have killed a million men and now they want me back again," and a shake of goose flesh went up my back. I turned to the card. It bore the typical rhyme sentiments. They always come to about the same, don't they? Merry Christmas, sure hope you don't die in the new year. I barely read them. On the blank side, facing the verse, she had written me a note. It was long enough to use up most of the white space. Dear number six, I just wanted to wish you the merriest of Merry Christmases and to tell you I'm okay. I'm not back in school, although I have been associating with certain school types, see enclosed clipping, and expect I will return eventually, probably fall semester next year. My mom is not doing too well, but she is trying, and my brother is getting his act back together. Rhonda helps, too. I've seen Sully a couple of times, but it's not the same. He came over to watch TV one night, and we are like strangers. Or maybe what I really mean is that we're like old acquaintances on trains going in different directions. I miss you, Pete. I think our trains are going in different directions, too, but I'll never forget the time we spent together. It was the sweetest and the best, especially the last night. You can write me if you want, but I sort of wish you wouldn't. It might not be good for either of us. This doesn't mean I don't care or remember, but that I do. Remember the night I showed you that picture and told you about how I got beaten up? How my friend Bobby took care of me? He had a book that summer. The man upstairs gave it to him. Bobby said it was the best book he ever read. Not saying much when you're just 11, I know. But I saw it again in the high school library when I was a senior and read it, just to see what it was like. And I thought it was pretty great. Not the best book I ever read, but pretty great. I thought you might like a copy. Although it was written 12 years ago, I sort of think it's about Vietnam. Even if it's not, it's full of information. I love you, Pete. Merry Christmas, Carol. P.S. Get out of that stupid card game. I read it twice, then folded the clipping carefully and put it back in the card, my hands still shaking. Somewhere I think I still have that card, as I'm sure that somewhere Red Carol Gerber has still got her little snapshot of her childhood friends. If she's still alive, that is. Not exactly a sure thing. A lot of her last known bunch of friends are not. I opened the package. Inside it, and in jarring contrast to the cheery Christmas paper and white satin ribbon, was a paperback copy of Lord of the Flies by William Golding. I had somehow missed it in high school, opting for a separate piece in senior lit instead because piece looked a little shorter. I opened it, thinking there might be an inscription. There was, but not the sort I had expected. Not at all. What I found in the white space on the title page was a Valentine heart, the sort a child might draw, followed by a plus sign, a peace sign, and then an equal sign. On the right side of the equation was one word. I spoke the whole thing aloud in a whisper that hardly escaped my mouth. Love plus peace equals information. My eyes filled with sudden, unexpected tears. I put my hands over my mouth to hold in the sob that wanted to come out. I didn't want to wake Nate up, didn't want him to see me crying. But I cried all right. I sat there at my desk and cried for her, for me, for both of us, for all of us. I can't remember hurting any more in my life than I did then. Hearts are tough, she said. Most times hearts don't break, and I'm sure that's right. But what about then? What about who we were then? What about hearts in Atlantis? In any case, Skip and I survived. We did the makeup work, squeaked through the finals, and returned to Chamberlain Hall in mid-January. Skip told me he'd written a letter to John Winken, the baseball coach, over the holiday, saying he'd changed his mind about coming out for the team. Nate was back on Chamberlain 3. So, amazingly, was Lenny Doria, on academic pro, but there. His paisan, Tony DeLuca, was gone, though. So were Mark St. Pierre, Barry Margot, Nick Prouty, Brad Witherspoon, Harvey Twiller, Randy Eccles, and Ronnie, of course. We got a card from him in March. It was postmarked Lewiston and simply addressed to the Yo-Yos of Chamberlain 3. We taped it up in the lounge, over the chair where Ronnie had most often sat during the games. On the front was Alfred E. Newman, the Mad Magazine cover boy. On the back, Ronnie had written, "Uncle Sam calls and I gotta go. Palm trees in my future and who gives an F blank blank K? What me worry? I finished with 21 match points. That makes me the winner." It was signed, Ron. Skip and I had a laugh at that. As far as we were concerned, Mrs. Malenfant's foul-mouthed little boy was going to be a Ronnie until the day he died. Stoke Jones, a.k.a. Rip Rip, was also gone. I didn't think of him much for a while, but his face and memory came back to me with startling, if brief, vividness a year and a half later. I was in jail at the time, in Chicago. I don't know how many of us the cops swept up outside the convention center on the night Hubert Humphrey was nominated, but there were a lot, and a lot of us were hurt. A Blue Ribbon Commission would a year later designate the event a police riot in its report. I ended up in a holding cell meant for 15 prisoners, 20 max, with about 60 gassed out, punched out, drugged out, beat up, messed up, worked over, fucked over, blood all over hippies. Some smoking joints, some crying, some puking, some singing protest songs. From far over in the corner, issuing from some guy I never even saw, came a stoned-out version of, "I'm not marching anymore." It was like some weird penal version of telephone booth cramming. I was jammed up against the bars, trying to protect my shirt pocket, Paul Mall's, and my hip pocket, the copy of Lord of the Flies Carol had given me, now very battered, missing half its front cover and falling out of its binding. When all at once, Stoke's face flashed into my mind as bright and complete as a high-resolution photograph. It came from nowhere, it seemed, perhaps the product of a dormant memory circuit which had gone momentarily hot, joggled by either a nightstick to the head or a revivifying whiff of tear gas. And a question came with it. "What the fuck was a cripple doing on the third floor?" I asked out loud. A little guy with a huge mass of golden hair, a kind of Peter Frampton dwarf, if you could dig that, looked around. His face was pale and pimply. Blood was drying beneath his nose and on one cheek. "What, man?" he asked. "What the fuck was a cripple doing on the third floor of a college dorm, one with no elevator? Wouldn't they have put him on the first floor?" Then I remembered Stoke plunging toward Holyoke with his head down and his hair hanging in his eyes, Stoke muttering "rip, rip, 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 rip" under his breath, Stoke going everywhere as if everything was his enemy. Give him a quarter and he'd try to shoot down the whole world. "Man, I'm not following you, what?" "Unless he asked them to," I said, "unless he maybe right out demanded it." "Bingo," said the little guy with the Peter Frampton hair. "Got a joint, man? I want to get high. This place sucks. I want to go to Hobbiton." Skip became an artist, and he's famous in his own way. Not like Norman Rockwell, and you'll never see a reproduction of one of Skip's sculptures on a plate offered by the Franklin Mint. But he's had plenty of shows. London, Rome, New York, last year in Paris. And he's reviewed regularly. There are plenty of critics who call him Jejun, the flavor of the month. Some have been calling him the flavor of the month for 25 years. A trite mind communicating via low imagery with other trite minds. Other critics have praised him for his honesty and energy. I tend in this direction, but I suppose I would. I knew him back in the day. We escaped the great sinking continent together, and he has remained my friend. In a distant way, he has remained my paisan. There are also critics who have commented on the rage his work so often expresses, the rage I first saw clearly in the papier-mâché Vietnamese family tableau he set afire in front of the school library to the amplified pulse of the Youngbloods back in 1969. And yeah, there's something to that. Some of Skip's stuff is funny, and some of it's sad, and some of it's bizarre, but most of it looks angry. Most of his stiff-shouldered plaster and paper and clay people seem to whisper, "Light me. Oh, light me and listen to me scream." It's really still 1969. It's still the Mekong, and always will be. It is Stanley Kirk's anger which makes his work worthy, a critic wrote during an exhibition in Boston, and I suppose it was that same anger which contributed to his heart attack 2 months ago. His wife called and said Skip wanted to see me. The doctors believed it hadn't been a serious cardiac event, but the captain begged to disagree. My old Paisan Captain Kirk thought he was dying. I flew down to Palm Beach, and when I saw him, white face below mostly white hair on a white pillow, it called up a memory I could not at first pin down. "You're thinking of Jones," he said in a husky voice, and of course he was right. I grinned, and at the same moment a cold chill traced a finger down the middle of my back. Sometimes things come back to you, that's all. Sometimes they come back. I came in and sat down beside him. "Not bad, O Swami." "Not hard, either," he said. "It's that day at the infirmary all over again, except that Carberry's probably dead, and this time I'm the one with the tube in the back of my hand." He raised one of his talented hands, showed me the tube, then lowered it again. "I don't think I'm going to die anymore. At least, not yet." "Good. You still smoking?"
"I've retired, as of last year."
He nodded. "My wife says she'll divorce me if I don't do the same, so I guess I better try."
"It's the worst habit."
"Actually, I think living's the worst habit."
"Save the phrase-making shit for the Reader's Digest, Cap."
He laughed, then asked if I'd heard from Nady.
"A Christmas card, like always, with a photo."
"Fucking Nate." Skip was delighted. "Was it his office?"
"Yeah. He's got a nativity scene out front this year. The Magi all look like they need dental work." We looked at each other and began to giggle. Before Skip could really get going, he began to cough. It was eerily like Stoke. For a moment, he even looked like Stoke. And I felt that shiver slide down my back again. If Stoke had been dead, I'd have thought he was haunting us, but he wasn't. And in his own way, Stoke Jones was as much of a sellout as every retired hippie who progressed from selling cocaine to selling junk bonds over the phone. He loves his TV coverage, does Stoke. When O.J. Simpson was on trial, you could catch Stoke somewhere on the dial every night, just another vulture circling the carrion. Carol was the one who didn't sell out, I guess. Carol and her friends, and what about the chem students they killed with their bomb? It was a mistake. I believe that with all my heart. The Carol Gerber I knew would have no patience with the idea that all power comes out of the barrel of a gun. The Carol I knew would have understood that was just another fucked-up way of saying we had to destroy the village in order to save it. But do you think the relatives of those kids cared that it was a mistake? The bomb didn't go off when it was supposed to? Sorry? Do you think questions of who sold out and who didn't matter to the mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, lovers, friends? Do you think it matters to the people who have to pick up the pieces and somehow go on? Hearts can break. Yes, hearts can break. Sometimes I think it would be better if we died when they did, but we don't. Skip worked on getting his breath back. The monitor beside his bed was beeping in a worried way. A nurse looked in and Skip waved her off. The beeps were settling back to their previous rhythm, so she went. When she was gone, Skip said, "Why did we laugh so hard when he fell down that day?" That question has never entirely left me.
"No," I said, "me either."
"So what's the answer? Why did we laugh?"
"Because we're human."
For a while, I think it was between Woodstock and Kent State, we thought we were something else, but we weren't.
"We thought we were stardust," Skip said, almost with a straight face.
"We thought we were golden, I agreed, laughing, and we've got to get ourselves back to the garden.
Lean over, hippie boy, Skip said, and I did. I saw that my old friend, who had outfoxed Deary and Ebersole and the Dean of Men, who had gone around and begged his teachers to help him, who had taught me to drink beer by the pitcher and say fuck in a dozen different intonations, was crying a little bit. He reached up his arms to me. They had gotten thin over the years, and now the muscles hung rather than bunched. I bent down and hugged him. "We tried," he said in my ear. "Don't you ever forget that, Pete. We tried." I suppose we did. In her way, Carol tried harder than any of us and paid the highest price, except, that is, for the ones who died. And although we've forgotten the language we spoke in those years, it is as lost as the bell-bottom jeans, home tie-dyed shirts, Nehru jackets, and signs that said, "Killing for peace is like fucking for chastity." Sometimes a word or two comes back. Information, you know. Information. And sometimes, in my dreams and memories, the older I get, the more they seem to be the same. I smell the place where I spoke that language with such easy authority. A whiff of earth, a scent of oranges, and the fading smell of flowers.
God bless us, everyone. Blind Willie. 6:15 a.m. He wakes to music, always to music. The shrill beep, beep, beep of the clock radio's alarm is too much for his mind to cope with during those first blurry moments of the day. It sounds like a dump truck backing up. The radio is bad enough at this time of year, though. The easy listening station he keeps the clock radio tuned to is wall-to-wall Christmas carols. And this morning he wakes up to one of the two or three on his most hated list, something full of breathy voices and phony wonder. The Hare Krishna Chorale or the Andy Williams Singers or some such. "Do you hear what I hear?" the breathy voices sing as he sits up in bed, blinking groggily, hair sticking out in every direction. "Do you see what I see?" they sing as he swings his legs out, grimaces his way across the cold floor to the radio, and bangs the button that turns it off. When he turns around, Sharon has assumed her customary defensive posture, pillow folded over her head, nothing showing but the creamy curve of one shoulder, a lacy nightgown strap, and a fluff of blonde hair. He goes into the bathroom, closes the door, slips off the pajama bottoms he sleeps in, drops them into the hamper, clicks on his electric razor. As he runs it over his face, he thinks, "Why not run through the rest of the sensory catalog while you're at it, boys? Do you smell what I smell? Do you taste what I taste? Do you feel what I feel? I mean, hey, go for it." "Humbug," he says as he turns on the shower. "All humbug." 20 minutes later, while he's dressing, the dark gray suit from Paul Stewart this morning, plus his favorite sulca tie, Sharon wakes up a little. Not enough for him to fully understand what she's telling him, though. "Come again?" he asks. "I got eggnog, but the rest was just ugga wugga." "I asked if you'd pick up 2 quarts of eggnog on your way home," she says. "We've got the Allens and the Dubrays coming over tonight, remember?" "Christmas," he says, checking his hair carefully in the mirror. He no longer looks like the glaring, bewildered man who sits up in bed to the sound of music 5 mornings a week, sometimes 6. Now he looks like all the other people who will ride into New York with him on the 740, and that is just what he wants. "What about Christmas?" she asks with a sleepy smile. "Humbug, right?" "Right," he agrees. "If you remember, get some cinnamon, too." "Okay. But if you forget the eggnog, I'll slaughter you, Bill." "I'll remember." "I know. You're very dependable. Look nice, too." "Thanks." She flops back down, then props herself up on one elbow as he makes a final minute adjustment to the tie, which is a dark blue. He has never worn a red tie in his life and hopes he can go to his grave untouched by that particular virus. "I got the tinsel you wanted," she says. "Hmm?" "The tinsel," she says. "It's on the kitchen table." "Oh," now he remembers. "Thanks." "Sure." She's back down and already starting to drift off again. He doesn't envy the fact that she can stay in bed until 9, hell, until 11 if she wants. But he envies that ability of hers to wake up, talk, then drift off again. He had that when he was in the bush. Most guys did, but the bush was a long time ago. In country was what the new guys and the correspondents always said. If you'd been there a while, it was just the bush, or sometimes the green. In the green, yeah. She says something else, but now she's back to ugga wugga. He knows what it is just the same, though. "Have a good day, hon." "Thanks," he says, kissing her cheek. "I will." "Look very nice," she mumbles again, although her eyes are closed. "Love you, Bill." "Love you, too," he says, and goes out. His briefcase, Mark Cross, not quite top of the line but close, is standing in the front hall by the coat tree where his top coat, from Tagers on Madison, hangs. He snags the case on his way by and takes it into the kitchen. The coffee is all made, God bless Mr. Coffee, and he pours himself a cup. He opens the briefcase, which is entirely empty, and picks up the ball of tinsel on the kitchen table. He holds it up for a moment, watching the way it sparkles under the light of the kitchen fluorescence, then puts it in his briefcase. "Do you hear what I hear?" he says to no one at all, and snaps the briefcase shut. 8:15 a.m. Outside the dirty window to his left, he can see the city drawing closer. The grime on the glass makes it look like some filthy, gargantuan ruin. Dead Atlantis, maybe, just heaved back to the surface to glare at the gray sky. The day's got a load of snow caught in its throat, but that doesn't worry him much. It is just 8 days until Christmas, and business will be good. The train car reeks of morning coffee, morning deodorant, morning aftershave, morning perfume, and morning stomachs. There is a tie in almost every seat. Even some of the women wear them these days. The faces have that puffy 8 o'clock look, the eyes both introspective and defenseless, the conversations half-hearted. This is the hour at which even people who don't drink look hungover. Most folks just stick to their newspapers. Why not? Reagan is king of America. Stocks and bonds have turned to gold. The death penalty is back in vogue. Life is good. He himself has the Times crossword open in front of him, and although he's filled in a few squares, it's mostly a defensive measure. He doesn't like to talk to people on the train, doesn't like loose conversation of any sort, and the last thing in the world he wants is a commuter buddy. When he starts seeing the same faces in any given car, when people start to nod to him or say, "How you doing today?" as they go to their seats, he changes cars. It's not that hard to remain unknown, just another commuter from suburban Connecticut, a man conspicuous only in his adamant refusal to wear a red tie. Maybe he was once a parochial school boy. Maybe once he held a weeping little girl while one of his friends struck her repeatedly with a baseball bat. And maybe he once spent time in the green. Nobody on the train has to know these things. That's the good thing about trains. "All ready for Christmas?" the man in the aisle seat asks him. He looks up, almost frowning, then decides it's not a substantive remark, only the sort of empty time passer some people seem to feel compelled to make. The man beside him is fat and will undoubtedly stink by noon, no matter how much speed stick he used this morning, but he's hardly even looking at Bill, so that's all right. "Yes, well, you know," he says, looking down at the briefcase between his shoes, the briefcase that contains a ball of tinsel and nothing else. "I'm getting in the spirit, little by little." 8:40 a.m. He comes out of Grand Central with 1,000 other top-coated men and women, mid-level executives for the most part, sleek gerbils who will be running full tilt on their exercise wheels by noon. He stands still for a moment, breathing deep of the cold gray air. Lexington Avenue is dressed in its Christmas lights, and a little distance away, a Santa Claus who looks Puerto Rican is ringing a bell. He's got a pot for contributions with an easel set up beside it. "Help the homeless this Christmas," the sign on the easel says, and the man in the blue tie thinks, "How about a little truth in advertising, Santa? How about a sign that says, 'Help me support my coke habit this Christmas'?" Nevertheless, he drops a couple of dollar bills into the pot as he walks past. He has a good feeling about today. He's glad Sharon reminded him of the tinsel. He would have forgotten to bring it, probably. In the end, he always forgets stuff like that. The grace notes. A walk of 10 minutes takes him to his building. Standing outside the door is a black youth, maybe 17, wearing black jeans and a dirty red hooded sweatshirt. He jives from foot to foot, blowing puffs of steam out of his mouth, smiling frequently, showing a gold tooth. In one hand he holds a partly crushed styrofoam coffee cup. There's some change in it, which he rattles constantly. "Spare a little?" he asks the passers-by as they stream toward the revolving doors. "Spare me a little, sir? Spare me just a little, ma'am? Just trying to get a spot of breakfast, thank you. God bless you. Merry Christmas. Spare a little, my man. Quarter, maybe, thank you. Spare a little, ma'am." As he passes, Bill drops a nickel and 2 dimes into the young black man's cup. "Thank you, sir. God bless. Merry Christmas." "You too," he says. The woman next to him frowns. "You shouldn't encourage them," she says. He gives her a shrug and a small, shame-faced smile. "It's hard for me to say no to anyone at Christmas," he tells her. He enters the lobby with a stream of others, stares briefly after the opinionated bitch as she heads for the newsstand, then goes to the elevators with their old-fashioned floor dials and their Art Deco numbers. Here, several people nod to him, and he exchanges a few words with a couple of them as they wait. It's not like the train, after all, where you can change cars. Plus, the building is an old one. The elevators are slow and cranky. "How's the wife, Bill?" a scrawny, constantly grinning man from the 5th floor asks. "Carol's fine. Kids?" "Both good." He has no kids, and his wife's name isn't Carol. His wife is the former Sharon Ann Donahue, St. Gabriel the Steadfast Secondary Parochial School, class of 1964, but that's something the scrawny, constantly grinning man will never know. "Bet they can't wait for the big day," the scrawny man says, his grin widening and becoming something unspeakable. To Bill Shearman, he looks like an editorial cartoonist's conception of death, all big eyes and huge teeth and stretched, shiny skin. That grin makes him think of Tamboy in the Ashau Valley. Those guys from 2nd Battalion went in looking like the kings of the world and came out looking like singed escapees from Hell's Half Acre. They came out with those big eyes and huge teeth. They still looked like that in Dong Ha, where they all got kind of mixed together a few days later. A lot of mixing together went on in the bush. A lot of shake and bake, too. Absolutely can't wait, he agrees. But I think Sarah's getting kind of suspicious about the guy in the red suit. Hurry up, elevator, he thinks. Jesus, save me from these stupidities. Yeah, yeah, it happens, the scrawny man says. His grin fades for a moment, as if they were discussing cancer instead of Santa. How old's Sarah now? 8. Seems like she was just born a year ago. Boy, the time sure flies when you're having fun, doesn't it? You can say that again, he says, fervently hoping the scrawny man won't say it again. At that moment, one of the four elevators finally gasps open its doors, and they herd themselves inside. Bill and the scrawny man walk a little way down the 5th-floor hall together, and then the scrawny man stops in front of a set of old-fashioned double doors with the words, Consolidated Insurance, written on one frosted glass panel, and Adjusters of America on the other. From behind these doors comes the muted clickety-clack of keyboards and the slightly louder sound of ringing phones. Have a good day, Bill. You too. The scrawny man lets himself into his office, and for a moment Bill sees a big wreath hung on the far side of the room. Also, the windows have been decorated with the kind of snow that comes in a spray can. He shudders and thinks, God save us, everyone. 9:05 a.m. His office, one of two he keeps in this building, is at the far end of the hall. The two offices closest to it are dark and vacant, a situation that has held for the last 6 months and one he likes just fine. Printed on the frosted glass of his own office door are the words, Western States Land Analysts. There are three locks on the door. The one that was on when he moved into the building, plus two he has put on himself. He lets himself in, closes the door, turns the bolt, then engages the police lock. A desk stands in the center of the room, and it is cluttered with papers, but none of them mean anything. They are simply window dressing for the cleaning service. Every so often he throws them all out and redistributes a fresh batch. In the center of the desk is a telephone on which he makes occasional random calls so that the phone company won't register the line as totally inactive. Last year, he purchased a copier, and it looks very businesslike over in its corner by the door to the office's little second room, but it has never been used. Do you hear what I hear? Do you smell what I smell? Do you taste what I taste? He murmurs, and crosses to the door leading to the second room. Inside are shelves stacked high with more meaningless paper, two large file cabinets. There is a Walkman on top of one, his excuse on the few occasions when someone knocks on the locked door and gets no answer, a chair, and a stepladder. Bill takes the stepladder back to the main room and unfolds it to the left of the desk. He puts his briefcase on top of it. Then he mounts the first three steps of the ladder, reaches up, the bottom half of his coat bells out and around his legs as he does, and carefully moves aside one of the suspended ceiling panels. Above is a dark area which cannot quite be called a utility space, although a few pipes and wires do run through it. There's no dust up here, at least not in this immediate area, and no rodent droppings either. He uses Decon mouse-proof once a month. He wants to keep his clothes nice as he goes back and forth, of course, but that's not really the important part. The important part is to respect your work and your field. This he learned in the Army during his time in the Green, and he sometimes thinks it is the second most important thing he's ever learned in his life. The most important is that only penance replaces confession, and only penance defines identity. This is a lesson he began learning in 1960, when he was 14. That was the last year he could go into the booth and say, "Bless me, Father, for I have sinned," and then tell everything. Penance is important to him. "God bless," he thinks there in the stale, smelling darkness of the utility space. "God bless you, God bless me, God bless us everyone." Above this narrow space, a ghostly gentle wind hoots endlessly through it, bringing a smell of dust and the groan of the elevators. It is the bottom of the sixth floor, and here is a square trapdoor about 30 inches on a side. Bill installed it himself. He's handy with tools, which is one of the things Sharon appreciates about him. He flips the trapdoor up, letting in muted light from above, then grabs his briefcase by the handle. As he sticks his head into the space between floors, water rushes gustily down the fat bathroom conduit 20 or 30 feet north of his present position. An hour from now, when the people in the building start their coffee breaks, that sound will be as constant and as rhythmic as waves breaking on a beach. Bill hardly notices this or any of the other interfloor sounds. He's used to them. He climbs carefully to the top of the stepladder, then boosts himself through into his sixth-floor office, leaving Bill down on 5. Up here, he is Willie again, just as he was in high school, just as he was in Vietnam, where he was sometimes known as Baseball Willie. This upper office has a sturdy workshop look, with coils and motors and vents stacked neatly on metal shelves, and what looks like a filter of some kind squatting on one corner of the desk. It is an office, however. There's a typewriter, a dictaphone, an in-out basket full of papers, also window dressing, which he periodically rotates like a farmer rotating crops, and file cabinets, lots of file cabinets. On one wall is a Norman Rockwell painting of a family praying over Thanksgiving dinner. Behind the desk is a framed studio portrait of Willie in his first lieutenant's uniform, taken in Saigon shortly before he won his Silver Star for action at the site of the helicopter crash outside of Dong Ha. And next to it is a blow-up of his honorable discharge, also framed. The name on the sheet is William Shearman, and here his decorations are duly noted. He saved Sullivan's life on the trail outside the Ville. The citation accompanying the Silver Star says so. The men who survived Dong Ha said so. And more important than either of those, Sullivan said so. It's the first thing he said when they wound up in San Francisco together at the hospital known as the Pussy Palace. "You saved my life, man." Willie sitting on Sullivan's bed, Willie with one arm still bandaged and salve all around his eyes, but really okay. Yeah, he was cruising. It was Sullivan who had been badly hurt. That was the day the AP photographer took their picture, the photo that appeared in newspapers all over the country, including the Harwich Journal. "He took my hand," Willie thinks, as he stands there in his sixth-floor office, with Bill Shearman now a floor down. Above the studio portrait and his discharge is a poster from the 60s. This item, not framed and starting to yellow at the edges, shows the peace sign. Below it, in red, white, and blue, is this punchline, "Track of the Great American Chicken." "He took my hand," he thinks again. Yes, Sullivan had done that, and Willie had come within an ace of leaping to his feet and running back down the ward, screaming. He had been positive that Sullivan would say, "I know what you did, you and your friends Doolin and O'Meara. Did you think she wouldn't tell me?" Sullivan had said nothing like that. What he'd said was, "You saved my life, man. From the old hometown, and you saved my life. Shit, what are the odds? And we used to be so scared of the boys from St. Gabe's." When he said that, Willie had known for sure that Sullivan had no idea of what Doolin, O'Meara, and he had done to Carol Gerber. There was no relief in knowing he was safe, however. None. And as he smiled and squeezed Sullivan's hand, he had thought, "You were right to be scared, Sully. You were right to be." Willie puts Bill's briefcase on the desk, then lies down.